and dark and restful with the sound of water running through the stone-lined channel in the floor. She loved going in there and waiting for her eyes to adjust to the darkness so she could admire the trailing fronds of dark green algae that clung to the stone, drifting in the current. Jamie had mentioned that a family of bats had taken up residence in the spring house too. Yes, there they were, four tiny bundles hung up in the darkest corner, each one barely 2 inches long, as neat and tidy as a Greek dolma wrapped in grape leaves. She smiled at the thought, though it was followed by a pang. She had eaten dolmas with Roger at a Greek restaurant in Boston. She didn't care all that much for Greek food, but it would have been a memory of their own time to share with him when she told him about the bats. If she told him now, she thought, he would smile in response, but the smile wouldn't quite reach his eyes, and she would remember alone. She left the spring house, walking slowly, the bucket of buttermilk in one hand, balanced by a wedge of cheese in the other. A cheese omelette would be good for lunch, quick to cook, and Jemmy loved it. He preferred to use his spoon to kill his prey than devour it messily with both hands, but he would feed himself, and that was progress. She was still smiling when she looked up from the path to see Obadiah Henderson sitting on her bench. "What are you doing here?" Her voice was sharp, but higher than she'd intended it to be. "The girl said you'd gone to Salem."
"So I had."
He rose to his feet and stepped forward, that knowing half-smile on his lips.
"I came back."
She suppressed the urge to take a step away. This was her house. Damned if he'd make her back away from her own door.
"Well, the girls have gone," she said, as coolly as she could manage. "They're at the Camerons'."
Her heart was thumping heavily, but she moved past him, meaning to put the bucket down on the porch. She bent, and he put his hand on the small of her back. She froze momentarily. He didn't move his hand, didn't try to stroke or squeeze, but the weight of it lay on her spine like a dead snake. She jerked upright and whirled around, taking a step back, and to hell with not letting him intimidate her. He'd already done that.
"I brought you something," he said, "from Salem."
The smile was still on his lips, but it seemed completely disconnected from the look in his eyes.
"I don't want it," she said. "I mean, thank you, but no, it isn't right for you to... My husband wouldn't like it." "No need for him to know."
He took a step toward her. She took one back, and the smile grew wider.
"I hear your husband's not home much these days," he said softly. "That sounds lonesome."
He put out a large hand reaching toward her face. Then there was an odd small sound, a sort of meaty thunk, and his face went blank, his eyes shot wide. She stared at him for a moment, completely unable to grasp what had happened. Then he turned those staring eyes to his outstretched hand, and she saw the small knife stuck in the flesh of his forearm and the growing stain of red on the shirt around it.
"Leave this place."
Jamie's voice was low but distinct. He stepped out of the trees, eyes fixed on Henderson in a most unfriendly manner. He reached them in three strides, put out his hand, and pulled the knife from Henderson's arm. Obadiah made a small sound deep in his throat, like a wounded animal might make, baffled and pitiable.
"Go," Jamie said. "Never come here again."
The blood was flowing down Obadiah's arm, dripping from his fingers. A few drops fell into the buttermilk, floating crimson on the rich yellow surface. In a dazed sort of way, she recognized the horrid beauty of it, like rubies set in gold.
Then the boy was going, free hand clamped to his wounded arm, shambling, then running for the trail. He disappeared into the trees, and the dooryard was very still.
"Did you have to do that?" was the first thing she managed to say. She felt stunned, as though she herself had been struck with something. The blood drops were beginning to blur, their edges dissolving into the buttermilk, and she thought she might throw up.
"Should I have waited?" Her father caught her by the arm, pulled her down to sit on the porch.
No, but you...
Couldn't you just have said something to him? Her lips felt numb, and there were small flashing lights in the periphery of her vision. Remotely, she realized that she was going to faint, and leaned forward, her head between her knees, face buried in the sanctuary of her apron.
I did. I told him to go.
The porch creaked as Jamie sat down beside her.
You know what I mean.
Her voice sounded odd to her own ears, muffled in the folds of cloth. She sat up slowly. The red spruce by the big house wavered slightly in her vision, but then steadied.
What were you doing? Showing off? How could you count on sticking somebody with a knife at that distance? And what was that anyway, a penknife?
Aye, it was all I had in my pocket. And in fact, I didn't mean to stick him, Jamie admitted. I meant to throw it into the wall of the cabin, and when he looked to see what made the noise, hit him from behind. He moved, though.
She closed her eyes and breathed deeply through her nose, willing her stomach to settle.
You're all right, Avionin? He asked quietly.
He laid a hand gently on her back, somewhat higher than Obadiah had. It felt good, large, warm, and comforting.
I'm fine, she said, opening her eyes.
He looked worried, and she made an effort, smiling at him.
Fine.
He relaxed a bit then, and his eyes grew less troubled, though they stayed intent on hers.
Well then, he said, it's no the first time, aye. How long has yon Gomeril been trying it on with you?
She took another breath and forced her fists to uncurl. She wanted to minimise the situation, moved by a sense of guilt, for surely she should have found some way to stop it. Faced with that steady blue gaze, though, she couldn't lie.
Since the first week, she said.
His eyes widened.
So long? And why did you not tell your man about it? He demanded, incredulous.
She was startled and fumbled for a reply.
I didn't think. I mean, it wasn't his problem.
She heard the sudden intake of his breath, no doubt the precursor to some biting remark about Roger, and hurried to defend him.
He didn't actually do anything. Just looks and smiles. How could I tell Roger he was looking at me? I didn't want to look weak or helpless.
Though she had been both, and knew it. The knowledge burned under her skin like ant bites.
I didn't want to have to ask him to defend me.
He stared at her, his face blank with incomprehension. He shook his head slowly, not taking his eyes away from her.
What in God's name do you think a man is for? He asked at last.
He spoke quietly, but in tones of complete bewilderment.
You want to keep him as a pet, is it? A lapdog? Or a caged bird?
You don't understand.
Oh, do I not?
He blew out a short breath in what might have been a sardonic laugh.
I've been married nearly 30 years, and you less than 2. What is it that you think I dinna understand, lass?
It isn't the same for you and Mama as it is for me and Roger, she burst out.
No, it's not,
he agreed, his voice level.
Your mother has regard for my pride, and I for hers. Or do you maybe think her a coward who canna fight her own battles?
No.
She swallowed, feeling perilously close to tears, but determined not to let them escape.
But, Da, it is different. We're from another place, another time.
I ken that fine, he said,
and she saw the edge of his mouth curl up in a wry half-smile. His voice grew more gentle.
But I kinda think that men and women are so different, then.
Maybe not.
She swallowed, forcing her voice to steady. But maybe Roger's different.
Since Alamance, He drew a breath as though to speak, but then let it out again slowly, saying nothing. He had taken his hand away. She felt the lack of it. He leaned back a little, looking out over the dooryard, and his fingers tapped lightly on the boards of the porch between them.
"Aye," he said at last quietly. "Maybe so."
She heard a muffled thump in the cabin behind them, then another. Jem was awake, throwing his toys out of his cradle. In a moment he would start calling for her to come and pick them up. She stood up suddenly, straightening her dress. "Jem's up. I have to go in." Jamie stood up too, and picking up the bucket, flung the buttermilk in a thick yellow splash across the grass.
"I'll fetch you more," he said,
and was gone before she could tell him not to bother. Jem was standing up, clinging to the side of his cradle, eager for escape, and launched himself into her arms when she bent to pick him up. He was getting heavy, but she clutched him tightly to her, pressing her cheek against his head, damp with sweaty sleep. Her heart was beating heavily, feeling bruised inside her chest.
"That sounds lonesome," Obadiah Henderson had said.
He was right. Chapter 80. Creamed Crud. Jamie leaned back from the table, sighing in repletion. As he started to get up, though, Mrs. Bug popped up from her place, wagging an admonitory finger at him.
"Now, sir, now, sir, you'll be going nowhere, and me left wi' gingerbread and fresh crud to go to waste."
Brianna clapped her hand to her mouth with a muffled noise characteristic of one who's just shot milk up one's nose. Jamie and Mr. Bug, to whom crud was the familiar Scottish usage for curds, both looked at her curiously but made no comment.
"Well, I'll surely burst, Mrs. Bug, but I expect I'll die a happy man," Jamie informed her. "Bring it on, then. But I've a wee thing to fetch whilst you serve it out."
With amazing agility for a man who had just consumed a pound or two of spiced sausage with fried apples and potatoes, he slid out of his chair and disappeared down the hall toward his study. I took a deep breath, pleased that I had smelled the gingerbread cooking earlier in the afternoon and had had the foresight to remove my stays before sitting down to supper.
"One crud,"
Jemmy crowed, picking up infallibly on the word most calculated to cause maternal consternation. He pounded his hands on the table in ecstasy, chanting, "Crud, crud, crud, crud," at the top of his lungs. Roger glanced at Bree with a half-smile, and I was pleased to see that she caught it, smiling back even as she captured Jemmy's hands and started the job of wiping the remains of dinner off his face. Jamie returned just as the gingerbread and curds, these being sugared and whipped into creamy blobs, made their appearance. He reached over Roger's shoulder as he passed and deposited a cloth-bound ledger on the table in front of him, topped with a small wooden box containing the astrolabe.
"The weather's good for another 2 months, maybe,"
he said casually, sitting down and sticking a finger into the huge dollop of creamed crud on his plate. He stuck the finger in his mouth, closing his eyes in bliss.
"Aye?"
The word came out choked and barely audible, but enough to make Jemmy quit babbling and stare at his father open-mouthed. I wondered whether it was the first time Roger had spoken today. Jamie had opened his eyes and picked up his spoon, eyeing his dessert with the determination of a man who means to die trying.
"Aye, well, Fergus will be going down to the coast just before snowfall. If he can take the surveying reports to be filed in New Bern, then, that will be good, no?"
He dug into the gingerbread in a businesslike way, not looking up. There was a silence, filled only with heavy breathing and the clack of spoons on wooden plates. Then Roger, who had not picked up his spoon, spoke.
"I couldn't do that."
It might have been no more than the effort it took to force air through his scarred throat, but there was an emphasis on the last word that made Brianna wince. Only slightly, but I saw it, and so did Roger. He glanced at her, then looked down at his plate, lashes dark against his cheek. His jaw tightened, and he picked up his spoon.
Good, then, Jamie said, even more casually. I'll show you how. You can go in a week.
Last night I dreamed that Roger was leaving. I've been dreaming about his going for a week ever since Dar suggested it. Suggested? Huh. Like Moses brought down the 10 suggestions from Mount Sinai. In the dream, Roger was packing things in a big sack, and I was busy mopping the floor. He kept getting in my way, and I kept pushing the sack aside to get in another part of the floor. It was filthy with all sorts of stains and sticky glop. There were little bones scattered round, like Adso had eaten some little animal there. And the bones kept getting caught up in my mop. I don't want him to go. But I do, too. I hear all the things he isn't saying. They echo in my head. I keep thinking that when he's gone, it'll be quiet. She passed abruptly from sleep to instant wakefulness. It was just past dawn, and she was alone. There were birds singing in the wood. One was caroling near the cabin, its notes sharp and musical. Was it a thrush? She wondered. She knew he was gone, but lifted her head to check. The rucksack was gone from beside the door, as was the bundle of food and bottle of cider she had prepared for him the night before. The bothron still hung in its place on the wall, seeming to float suspended in the unearthly light. She had tried to get him to play again, after the hanging, feeling that at least he could still have music, if not his voice. He had resisted, though, and finally she could see that she was angering him with her insistence, and had stopped. He would do things his way, or not at all. She glanced toward the cradle, but all was quiet. Jemmy is still sound asleep. She lay back on her pillow, hands lifting to her breasts. She was naked, and they were smooth, round, and full as gourds. She squeezed one nipple gently, and tiny pearls of milk popped out. One swelled bigger, overflowed, and ran in a tiny trickling droplet down the side of her breast. They had made love before sleeping, the night before. At first, she hadn't thought he would, but when she came up to him and put her arms around him, he had clasped her hard against himself, kissed her slowly for a long, long time, and finally carried her to bed. She had been so anxious for him, wanting to assure him of her love with mouth and hands and body, to give him something of herself to take away, that she'd forgotten herself completely and been surprised when the climax overtook her. She slid one hand down between her legs, remembering the sense of being caught up suddenly by a great wave swept helplessly toward shore. She hoped that Roger had noticed. He hadn't said anything, nor opened his eyes. He had kissed her goodbye in the dark before dawn, still silent. Or had he? She put a hand to her mouth, suddenly unsure, but there was no clue in the smooth, cool flesh of her lips. Had he kissed her goodbye? Or had she only dreamed it? Chapter 81. Bear Killer. August 1771. The horses, neighing from the direction of the paddock, announced company. Curious, I abandoned my latest experiment and went to peer out of the window. Neither horse nor man was in evidence in the dooryard, but the horses were still snorting and carrying on as they did when they saw someone new. The company must be afoot, then, and have gone round to the kitchen door, which most people did, this being mannerly. This supposition was almost instantly borne out by a high-pitched shriek from the back of the house. I poked my head out into the hall just in time to see Mrs. Bug race out of the kitchen as though discharged from a cannon, screaming in panic. Not noticing me, she shot past and out of the front door, which she left hanging open, thus enabling me to see her cross the dooryard and vanish into the woods, still in full cry. It came as something of an anticlimax when I glanced the other way and saw an Indian standing in the kitchen doorway, looking surprised. We eyed each other warily, but as I appeared indisposed to screaming and running, he relaxed slightly.
As he appeared unarmed and lacking paint or any other evidence of malevolent intent, I relaxed slightly.
Osio,
I said cautiously, having observed that he was a Cherokee and dressed for visiting. He wore three calico shirts, one atop the other, homespun breeches, and the odd drooping cap, rather like a half-wound turban that men favoured for formal occasions, plus long silver earrings and a handsome brooch in the shape of the rising sun. He smiled brilliantly in response to my greeting and said something I didn't understand at all. I shrugged helplessly, but smiled in return, and we stood there, nodding at one another and smiling back and forth for several moments, until the gentleman, struck by inspiration, reached into the neck of his innermost shirt, a dressy number printed with small yellow diamonds on a blue background, and withdrew a leather thong on which were strung the curved black claws of one or more bears. He held these up, rattled them gently, and raised his eyebrows, glancing to and fro as though searching for someone under the table or on the cabinet.
"Oh," I said, comprehending immediately.
"You want my husband?" I mimed someone aiming a rifle.
"The bear killer?"
A flash of good teeth in a beaming smile rewarded my intelligence.
"I expect he'll be along any minute," I said, waving first at the window, indicating the path taken by the exiting Mrs. Bug, who had undoubtedly gone to inform himself that there were red savages in the house, bent on murder, mayhem, and the desecration of her clean floor, and then in the direction of the kitchen. "Come back, won't you, and have a drink of something?"
He followed me willingly, and we were seated at the table, companionably sipping tea and exchanging further nods and smiles, when Jamie came in, accompanied not only by Mrs. Bug, who stuck close to his coat-tails, casting suspicious looks at our guest, but by Peter Bewley. Our guest was promptly introduced as Tsatsawi, the brother of Peter's Indian wife. He lived in a small town some 30 miles past the treaty line, but had come to visit his sister and was staying with the Bewleys for a time.
"We were having a wee pipe after our supper last night," Peter explained.
"And Tsatsawi was a telling of my wife about a difficulty in the village, and she telling it to me, you see, him having no English, and me not speaking so very much of their tongue, no but the names of things and the odd politeness here and there. But, as I say, he was a telling of a wicked bear that's been a plaguing of them for months past."
"I should think Tsatsawi's well equipped to deal with such a creature by the looks of it," Jamie said, nodding at the Indian's necklace of claws and touching his own chest in indication.
He smiled at Tsatsawi, who evidently gathered the meaning of the compliment, and smiled broadly back. Both men bowed slightly to each other over the cups of tea, in token of mutual respect.
"Aye," Peter agreed, licking droplets of liquid from the corners of his mouth and smacking his lips in approval. "He's a bonny hunter, is Tsatsawi, and in the usual course of things, I expect he and his cousins might manage well enough. But it seems as though this particular bear is just that wee bit above the odds. So I says to him as perhaps we'll come and tell McDo about it, and maybe as himself would spare the time to go and sort the creature for them."
Peter lifted his chin to his brother-in-law and nodded toward Jamie with a proprietorial air of pride.
"See," said the gesture, "I told you. He can do it."
I suppressed a smile at this. Jamie caught my eye, coughed modestly, and set down his cup.
"Aye, well, I canna come just yet a while, but perhaps when the hay is in. D'ye ken what's the nature of this problematical bear, Peter?"
"Oh, aye," Peter said cheerfully. "It's a ghost."
I choked momentarily on my own tea. Jamie didn't seem too shocked, but rubbed his chin dubiously.
"Mm-hmm. Well, what's it done, then?"
The bear had first made its presence known nearly a year before, though no one had seen it for some time. There had been the usual incidents of depredation, the carrying away of racks of drying fish or strings of corn hung outside houses, the stealing of meat from lean-tos. But at first, the townspeople had regarded this merely as the work of a bear slightly more clever than the usual bear being completely unconcerned as to whether he was observed in the act. "It will only come at night, you see," Peter explained, "and it didn't make a great deal of noise. Folk would just come out in the morning and find their stores broken into, and not a sound made to rouse them." Brianna, who had seen Mrs. Bug's unceremonious exit and come up to investigate the cause, began humming softly under her breath a song to which memory promptly supplied the words. "Oh, he'll sleep till noon, but before it's dark, he'll have every picnic basket that's in Jellystone Park." I pressed a napkin to my mouth, ostensibly to blot the remains of the tea. "The Kent it was a bear from the first, aye," Peter explained. "Footprints." Tsatsawi knew that word. He spread his two hands out on the table, thumb to thumb, demonstrating the span of the footprint, then touched the longest of the claws hung round his neck, nodding significantly. The townspeople, thoroughly accustomed to bears, had taken the usual precautions, moving supplies into more protected areas and putting out their dogs in the evening. The result of this was that a number of dogs had disappeared, again without sound. Evidently the dogs had grown warier, or the bear hungrier. The first victim was a man, killed in the forest. Then, 6 months ago, a child had been taken. Brianna stopped humming abruptly. The victim was a baby, snatched cradle-board and all from the bank of the river where its mother was washing clothes toward sunset. There had been no sound and no clue left save a large clawed footprint in the mud. Four more of the townspeople had been killed in the month since. Two children picking wild strawberries by themselves in late afternoon. One body had been found, the neck broken, but otherwise untouched. The other had disappeared. Marks showed where it had been dragged into the woods. A woman had been killed in her own cornfield, again towards sunset, and partially eaten where she fell. The last victim, a man, had in fact been hunting the bear.
"They didn't find anything of him, save his bow and a few bits of blooded clothes," Peter said.
I heard a small thump behind me as Mrs. Bug sat down abruptly on the settle. "So they've hunted it themselves," I asked. "Or tried to, I should say." Peter took his eyes off Jamie and looked at me, nodding seriously.
"Oh, aye, Mrs. Clare. That's how they kent what it was, finally."
A small party of hunters had gone out loaded, literally, for bear, armed with bows, spears, and the two muskets the village boasted. They had circled the village in a widening gyre, convinced that since the bear's attention focused on the town, it wouldn't wander far away. They had searched for 4 days, now and then finding old spoor, but no trace of the bear itself.
"Tsatsawi was wee 'em then," Peter said, lifting a finger toward his brother-in-law. "He and one of his friends were sitting up at night keeping watch while the others slept. 'Twas just past moonrise," he said, "when he got up to make water. He turned back to the fire, just in time to see his friend being dragged off, stone dead, with his neck crushed in the jaws of the thing itself."
Tsatsawi had been following the tale intently. At this juncture he nodded, and made a gesture that appeared to be the Cherokee equivalent of the sign of the cross, some quick and formal gesture to repel evil. He began to talk himself then, hands flying as he pantomimed the subsequent events. He had, of course, shouted, rousing his remaining comrades, and had rushed at the bear, hoping to frighten it into dropping his friend, though he could see that the man was already dead. He tilted his head sharply to indicate a broken neck, letting his tongue loll in an expression that would have been quite funny under different circumstances. The hunters were accompanied by two dogs, which had also flown at the bear, barking. The bear had, in fact, dropped its prey, but instead of fleeing, had charged toward him. He had thrown himself to one side, and the bear had paused long enough to swipe one of the dogs off its feet, and then disappeared into the darkness of the wood, pursued by the other dog, a hail of arrows, and a couple of musket balls, none of which had touched it. They had chased the bear into the woods with torches, but been unable to discover it. The second dog had returned, looking ashamed of itself. Brianna made a small fizzing noise at Tsatsawi's pantomime of the dog, and the hunters, thoroughly unnerved, had gone back to their fire and spent the rest of the night awake.
before returning to their village in the morning, from whence, Tsatsawi indicated with a graceful gesture, he had now come to solicit the assistance of the bear killer.
But why do they think it's a ghost?
Brianna leaned forward, interest displacing her initial horror at the tale. Peter glanced at her, one eyebrow raised.
Oh, aye, didn't I see? Or rather, I expect he did, but not so's you'd understand it. The thing was much bigger than the usual bear, he says. And pure white. He says when it turned to look at him, the beast's eyes glowed red as flame. They kent at once it must be a ghost, and so they weren't really surprised that their arrows didn't touch it.
Tsatsawi broke in again, pointing first at Jamie, then tapping his bear claw necklace, and then, to my surprise, pointing at me. Me? I said. What have I got to do with it? The Cherokee heard my tone of surprise, for he leaned across the table, took my hand in his own, and stroked it. Not in any affectionate manner, but merely as an indication of my skin. Jamie made a small sound of amusement.
You're very white, Sassenach. Perhaps the bear will think you're a kindred spirit.
He grinned at me, but Tsatsawi evidently gathered the sense of this, for he nodded seriously. He dropped my hand and made a brief cawing noise. A raven's call.
Oh, I said, distinctly uneasy.
I didn't know the words in Cherokee, but evidently the people of Tsatsawi's town had heard of White Raven as well as the bear killer. Any white animal was regarded as being significant, and often sinister. I didn't know whether the implication here was that I might exert some power over the ghost bear, or merely serve as bait, but evidently I was indeed included in the invitation. And so it was that a week later, the hay safely in, and four sides of venison peacefully hanging in the smokehouse, we set off toward the treaty line, bent on exorcism.
This ends Disc 33. The Fiery Cross, Disc 34.
Besides Jamie and myself, the party consisted of Brianna and Jimmy, the two Beardsley twins, and Peter Bewley, who was to guide us to the village, his wife having gone ahead with Tsatsawi. Brianna hadn't wanted to come, more for fear of taking Jemmy into the wilderness than from disinclination to join the hunt, I thought. Jamie had insisted that she come, though, claiming that her marksmanship would be invaluable. Unwilling to wean Jemmy yet, she'd been obliged to bring him, though he seemed to be thoroughly enjoying the trip, hunched bright-eyed on the saddle in front of his mother, alternately gabbling happily to himself about everything he saw, or sucking his thumb in dreamy content. As for the Beardsleys, it was Josiah that Jamie wanted.
"The lad's killed two bears at least," he told me. "I saw the skins at the gathering. And if his brother likes to come along, I can't see the harm in it."
"Neither do I agreed. "But why are you making Bree come? Can't you and Josiah handle the bear between you?"
"Perhaps," he said, running an oily rag over the barrel of his gun. "But if two heeds are better than one, then a third should be better still, no? Especially if it shoots like yon lass can."
"Yes," I said sceptically. "And what else?" He glanced up at me and grinned.
"What? You dinna think I have ulterior motives, do you, Sassenach?"
"No, I don't think so. I know so." He laughed and bent his head over his gun. After a few moments swabbing and cleaning, though, he said, not looking up,
"Aye, well, I thought it no bad idea for the lass to have friends among the Cherokee. In case she should need a place to go sometime."
The casual tone of voice didn't fool me. "Sometime. When the revolution comes, you mean?"
"Aye. Or when we die. Whenever that might be,"
he added precisely, picking the gun up and squinting down the barrel to check the sight. It was bright Indian summer still, but I felt the shards of ice crackle down my back.
Most days I manage to forget that newspaper clipping, the one that reported the death by fire of one James Fraser and his wife on Fraser's Ridge. Other days I remembered it, but shoved the possibility to the back of my mind, refusing to dwell on it. But every now and then I would wake up at night with bright flames leaping in the corners of my mind, shivering and terrified. "The clipping said, 'No living children,'" I said, determined to face down the fear. "Do you suppose that means that Bree and Roger will have gone somewhere before then? To the Cherokee, perhaps? Or to the stones?"
"It might."
His face was sober, eyes on his work. Neither one of us was willing to admit the other possibility. No need, in any case. Reluctant though she had been to come, Brianna too seemed to be enjoying the trip. Without Roger, and relieved of the chores of cabin housekeeping, she seemed much more relaxed, laughing and joking with the Beardsley twins, teasing Jamie, and nursing Jemmy by the fire at night before curling herself around him and falling peacefully asleep. The Beardsleys were having a good time too. The removal of his infected adenoids and tonsils hadn't cured Keziah's deafness, but had improved it markedly. He could understand fairly loud speech now, particularly if you faced him and spoke clearly, though he seemed to make out anything his twin said with ease, no matter how softly voiced. Seeing him look round wide-eyed as we rode through the thick insect-buzzing forest, fording streams and finding faint deer paths through the thickets, I realised that he had never been anywhere in his life, save the area near the Beardsley farm and Fraser's Ridge. I wondered what he would make of the Cherokee, and they of him and his brother. Peter had told Jamie that the Cherokee regarded twins as particularly blessed and lucky. The news that the Beardsleys would be joining the hunt had delighted Satsawi. Josiah seemed to be having fun too, insofar as I could tell, he being a very contained sort of person. As we drew closer to the village, though, I thought that he was becoming slightly nervous. I could see that Jamie was a trifle uneasy too, though in his case I suspected the reason for it. He didn't mind at all going to help with the hunt, and was pleased to have the opportunity to visit the Cherokee. But I rather thought that having his reputation as the bear killer trumpeted before him, so to speak, was making him uncomfortable. This supposition was borne out when we camped on the third night of our journey. We were no more than 10 miles from the village and would easily make it by midday next day. I could see him making up his mind to something as we rode, and as we all sat down to supper around a roaring fire, I saw him suddenly set his shoulders and stand up. He walked up to Peter Bewley, who sat staring dreamily into the fire, and faced him with decision.
"There's a wee thing I have to be saying, Peter, about this ghost bear we're off to find."
Peter looked up, startled out of his trance. He smiled, though, and slid over to make room for Jamie to sit down.
"Oh, aye, McDo."
Jamie did so and cleared his throat.
"Well, you see, the fact is that I dinna actually ken a great deal about bears, as there havena been any in Scotland for quite some years now."
Peter's eyebrows went up.
"But they say you killed a great bear with naught but a duck."
Jamie rubbed his nose with something approaching annoyance.
"Ah, well, so I did then. But I didn't hunt the creature down. It came after me, so I hadn't got a choice about it after all. I'm none so sure I shall be of any great help in discovering this ghost bear. It must be a particularly clever bear, no? To have been walking in and out of their village for months, I mean, and no one with more than a single glimpse of it."
"Smarter than the average bear,"
Brianna agreed, her mouth twitching slightly. Jamie gave her a narrow look, which he switched to me as I choked on a swallow of beer.
"What?"
he demanded testily.
"Nothing," I gasped. "Nothing at all."
Turning his back on us in disgust, Jamie suddenly caught sight of Josiah Beardsley, who, while not guffawing, was doing a little mouth-twitching of his own.
"What?"
Jamie barked at him.
"There's no but loons."
He jerked a thumb over his finger at Brianna and me. But what's to do with you, eh?
Josiah immediately erased the grin from his face and tried to look grave, but the corner of his mouth kept on twitching, and a hot flush was rising in his narrow cheeks, visible even by firelight. Jamie narrowed his eyes, and a stifled noise that might have been a giggle escaped Josiah. He clapped a hand across his mouth, staring up at Jamie.
"What then?" Jamie inquired politely.
Keziah, obviously gathering that something was up, hunched closer to his twin, squaring up beside him in support. Josiah made a brief unconscious movement toward Kezi, but didn't look away from Jamie. His face was still red, but he seemed to have got himself under control.
"Well, I suppose I'd best say so."
"I suppose you had."
Jamie gave him a quizzical look. Josiah drew a deep breath, resigning himself.
"'Twasn't a bear always. Sometimes it was me."
Jamie stared at him for a moment, then the corners of his mouth began to twitch.
"Why?"
"Not all the time," Josiah explained. "But when his wanderings through the wilderness brought him within reach of one of the Indian villages..." "Only if I was hungry, though, sir," he hastened to add.
He would lurk cautiously in the forest nearby, stealing into the place after dark and absconding with any easily reached edibles. He would remain in the area for a few days, eating from the village stores until his strength and his pack were replenished, then move on to hunt, eventually returning with his hides to the cave where he had made a cache. Kezi's expression throughout this recital hadn't changed. I wasn't sure how much of it he had heard, but he didn't appear surprised. His hand rested on his twin's arm for a moment, then slid off, reaching for a skewer of meat. Brianna's laughter had subsided, and she'd been listening to Josiah's confession with a furrowed brow.
"But you didn't... I mean, I'm sure you didn't take the baby in its cradle board, and you didn't kill the woman who was partly eaten, did you?"
Josiah blinked, though he seemed more baffled than shocked by the question.
"Oh, no... Why'd I do that? You don't think I ate them, do you?"
He smiled at that, an incongruous dimple appearing in one cheek.
"Mind, I've been hungry enough now and then as I might consider it if I happened on somebody dead, providing it was fairly recent," he added judiciously. "But not hungry enough as I'd kill someone a purpose."
Brianna cleared her throat with something startlingly like one of Jamie's Scottish noises.
"No, I didn't think you ate them," she said dryly. "I just thought if someone happened to have killed them for some other reason, the bear could have come along and gnawed on the bodies."
Peter nodded thoughtfully, seeming interested but unfazed by the assorted confessions.
"Aye, a bear'll do that," he said. "They're no picky eaters, bears. Carrion is fine by them."
Jamie nodded in response, but his attention was still fixed on Josiah.
"Aye, I've heard that forby.
But Satsawi said he did see the bear take his friend, so it does kill people, no?"
"Well, it killed that one," Josiah agreed.
There was an odd tone to his voice, though, and Jamie's look sharpened. He lifted a brow at Josiah, who worked his lips slowly in and out, deciding something. He glanced at Kezi, who smiled at him. Kezi, I saw, had a dimple in his left cheek, while Josiah's was in the right. Josiah sighed and turned back to face Jamie.
"I wasn't going to see anything about this part," he said frankly. "But you've been straight with us, sir, and I see it ain't right to let you go after that bear, not knowing what else might be there."
I felt the hairs rise on the back of my neck, and resisted the sudden impulse to turn round and look into the shadows behind me. The urge to laugh had left me.
"What else?"
Jamie slowly lowered the chunk of bread he'd been about to bite into.
"And just what else might be there, then?"
"Well, 'twas only the once I saw for sure, mind," Josiah warned him. "It was a moonless night, too. But I'd been out all the night, and my eyes was well accustomed to the starlight. You know the way of it, sir."
Jamie nodded, looking bemused.
Aye, well enough. And you were where at the time?
Near the village we were headed toward. Josiah had been there before and was familiar with the layout of the place. A house at the end of the village was his goal. There were strings of corn hung to dry beneath the eaves, and he thought he could get away with one easily enough, provided he didn't rouse the village dogs.
"Rouse one, you've got 'em all a-yowling on your tail," he said, shaking his head. And it wasn't but a couple of hours before the dawn. So I crept along, slow-like, looking to see was one of the rascals curled up asleep by the house I had my eye on.
Lurking in the wood, he had seen a figure come out of the house.
As no dogs took exception to this, it was a reasonable conclusion that the person belonged to the house.
The man had paused to make water, and then, to Josiah's alarm, had shouldered a bow and quiver and marched directly toward the woods where he lay hidden.
I didn't think as he could be after me, but I went up a tree quick as a bobtail cat, and not making no more noise than one neither, he said, not bragging.
The man had most likely been a hunter, making an early start for a distant stream where raccoon and deer would come to drink at dawn. Not seeing any need of caution so near his own village, the man hadn't displayed any, walking through the forest quietly but with no attempt at concealment. Josiah had crouched in his tree, no more than a few feet above the man's head, holding his breath. The man had gone on, disappearing at once into the heavy undergrowth. Josiah had been just about to descend from his perch when he heard a sudden exclamation of surprise, followed by the sounds of a brief scuffle that concluded with a sickening thunk.
"Just like a ripe squash when you chunk it with a rock to break it open," he assured Jamie. "Made my arsehole draw up like a purse string, hearing that noise there in the dark."
Alarm was no bar to curiosity, though, and he had eased through the wood in the direction of the sound. He could hear a rustling noise, and as he peered cautiously through a screen of cedar branches, he made out a human form stretched upon the ground, and another bending over it, evidently struggling to pull some kind of garment off the prone man's body.
"He was dead," Josiah explained matter-of-factly. "I could smell the blood, and I shit smelled too. Reckon the little fella caved in his head with a rock or maybe a club." "Little fella?"
Peter had been following the story with close attention.
"How little do you mean? Did you see his face?"
Josiah shook his head.
"No, I saw naught but the shadow of him moving about. It was full dark still. The sky hadn't started to go light yet."
He squinted, making a mental estimate.
"Reckon he'd be shorter than me, maybe so high."
He held out a hand in illustration, measuring a distance some 4.5 feet from the ground. The murderer had been interrupted in his work of plundering the body, though. Josiah, intent on watching, had noticed nothing until there came a sudden crack from a breaking stick and the inquiring woof of a questing bear.
"You'd best believe the little fella run when he heard that," he assured Jamie. "He dashed right past, no further from me than you are now. That was when I got the only good look I had at him."
"Well, don't keep us in suspense," I said, as he paused to take a gulp of his beer. "What did he look like?"
He wiped a line of foam from the sparse whiskers on his upper lip, looking thoughtful.
"Well, ma'am, I was pretty near sure he was the devil. Only I did think the devil would be bigger," he added, taking another drink. This statement naturally caused some confusion.
Upon further elucidation, it appeared that Josiah merely meant that the mysterious little fella had been black.
"Wasn't till I went along to that gathering of yours that it come to me that some regular folks just are black," he explained. "I've never seen anybody who was, nor heard tell of it neither."
Kezzy nodded soberly at this.
"Devil in the book," he said, in his odd, gruff voice.
The book, it seemed, was an old Bible that Aaron Beardsley had taken somewhere in trade and never found a buyer for. Neither of the boys had ever been taught to read, but they were most entertained by the pictures in the book, which included several drawings of the devil, depicted as a crouching black creature, going about his sly business of tempting and seduction.
"I didn't see no forked tail," Josiah said, shaking his head. "But then, he went by so fast, stood to reason I might have missed it in the dark and all."
Not wanting to draw the attention of such a person to himself, Josiah had stood still, and thus been in a position to hear the bear giving its attention to the unfortunate inhabitant of the village.
"It's like Mr. Peter says," he said,
nodding at Peter Bewley in acknowledgement.
"Bears ain't particular. I never did see this un, so I can't say was it the white one or no. But it surely did eat on that Indian. I heard it chawing and slobbering like anything."
He seemed untroubled by this recollection, but I saw Brianna's nostrils pinch at the thought. Jamie exchanged looks with Peter, then glanced back at Josiah. He rubbed a forefinger slowly down the bridge of his nose, thinking.
"Well, then," he said at last, "it seems that not all the evil doings in your brother-in-law's village can be laid at the ghost bear's door, eh? What with Josiah stealing food, and we black devils killing folk."
"What do you ken, Peter?
Might a bear take a taste for human flesh once he'd had it, and then maybe go to hunting humans on his own?"
Peter nodded slowly, face creased in concentration.
"That might be, McDo," he allowed. "And if there's a wee black bastard hanging about in the wood, who's to say how many bears killed and how many the wee black devil's done for, and the bear taking the blame?"
"But who is this wee black devil?" Bree asked.
The men looked from one to another and shrugged, more or less in unison.
"It must be an escaped slave, surely," I said, lifting my brows at Jamie. "I can't see why a free black in his right mind would go off into the wilderness alone like that."
"Maybe he isn't in his right mind," Bree suggested. "Slave or free, if he's going around killing people, I mean."
She cast an uneasy look at the wood around us and put a hand on Jimmy, who was curled in a blanket on the ground beside her, sound asleep. The men looked automatically to their weapons, and even I reached under my apron to touch the knife I wore at my belt for digging and chopping. The forest seemed suddenly both sinister and claustrophobic. It was much too easy to imagine lurking eyes in the shadows, ascribe the constant soft rustle of leaves to stealthy footsteps, or the brush of passing fur. Jamie cleared his throat.
"Your wife's not mentioned black devils, I suppose, Peter?"
Bewley shook his head. The concern with which he had greeted Josiah's tale was still stamped upon his grizzled face, but a small touch of amusement gleamed in his eyes.
"No, I can't say she has, McDo. The only thing I can call in that regard is the Black Man of the West."
"And who's that?" Josiah asked, interested.
Peter shrugged and scratched at his beard. "Ah, well, I shouldn't say it's anyone, so to speak. Only that the shamans say there is a spirit who lives in each of the four directions, and each spirit has a colour to him. So when they go to singing their prayers and the like, they'll maybe call the Red Man of the East to help the person they're singing for, because red is the colour of triumph and success. North, that's blue. The Blue Man, to give the spirit of the North his right name, that's defeat and trouble. So you'd call on him to come and give your enemy a bit of grief, aye? To the south, that's the White Man, and he's peace and happiness. They sing to him for the women with child and the like."
Jamie looked both startled and interested to hear this.
"That's very like the Four Erts, Peter, is it no?"
"Well, it is then," Peter agreed, nodding.
"Odd, no, that the Cherokee should get hold of the same notions as we Highlanders have." "Oh, not so much."
Jamie gestured to the dark wood beyond the small circle of our fire.
"They live as we do, eh? Hunters and dwellers in the mountains. Why should they not see what we've seen?"
Peter nodded slowly, but Josiah was impatient with his philosophizing.
"Well, what's the Black Man of the West, then?" he demanded.
Both Jamie and Peter turned their heads as one to look at him. The two men looked nothing alike. Peter was short, squat, and genially bearded. Jamie, tall and elegant, even in his hunting clothes. And yet there was something identical in their eyes that made little mouse feet run skittering down my spine.
What we have seen, indeed, I thought. The West is the home of the dead,
Jamie said softly. And Peter nodded soberly.
And the black man of the West is death himself, he added. Or Susie the Cherokee.
Josiah was heard to mutter that he didn't think so very much of that idea, but Brianna thought even less of it.
I do not believe that the spirit of the West was out in the woods conking people on the head, she declared firmly. It was a person Josiah saw, and it was a black person. Ergo, it was either a free black or an escaped slave. And given the odds, I vote for escaped slave. I wasn't sure it was a matter for democratic process, but I was inclined to agree with her. Here's another thought, she said, looking round. What if it's this little black man who's responsible for some of the half-eaten people? Aren't some of the African slaves cannibals? Peter Bewley's eyes popped at that. So did the Beardsleys. Kezzy cast an uneasy look over his shoulder and edged closer to Josiah.
Jamie appeared amused at this suggestion, though.
Well, I suppose you might get the odd cannibal here and there in Africa, he agreed. Though I canna say I've heard of one amongst the slaves. I shouldn't think they'd be very desirable as house servants, I. You'd be afraid to turn your back for fear of being bitten in the backside.
This remark made everyone laugh and relieved the tension somewhat. People began to stir and make preparations for going to bed. We took especial care in putting the food into two of the saddlebags, which Jamie hung up in a tree, a good distance from the camp. Even if the ghost bear had been revealed to be less powerful than previously supposed, there was an unspoken agreement that there was no sense taking chances. For the most part, I managed to put aside the knowledge that we lived in a wilderness. Now and then some tangible evidence would shove the fact under my nose. Nocturnal visits by foxes, possums, and raccoons, or the occasional unnerving screams of panthers, with their uncanny resemblance to the crying of women or the shrieks of small children. It was quiet now, where we were, but there was no way of standing in the centre of those mountains at night, submerged in the absolute black at their feet, listening to the secret murmurs of the great trees overhead, and pretending that one was anywhere but in the grip of the forest primeval, or of doubting that the wilderness could swallow us in one gulp, if it cared to, leaving not a clue behind of our existence. For all her logic, Brianna was by no means immune to the whispers of the forest, not with a small and tender child to guard. She didn't help with the readying of camp for the night, but instead sat close to Jemmy, loading her rifle. Jamie, after a quick look at Brianna, announced that he and she would take the first watch, Josiah and I the next, and Peter and Kezzy the last watch of the night. Heretofore we hadn't kept a watch, but no one complained at this suggestion. A long day in the saddle is one of the best soporifics, and I lay down beside Jamie with that utter gratitude for being horizontal that compensates for the hardest of beds. Jamie's hand rested gently on my head. I turned my face and kissed his palm, feeling safe and protected. Peter and the Beardsley twins fell asleep within seconds. I could hear them snoring on the other side of the fire. I was nearly asleep myself, lulled by the quiet, half-heard talk between Jamie and Bree, when I became aware that the tenor of their conversation had changed.
"Are you worried for your man, Ian?"
he asked softly. She gave a small, unhappy laugh. "I've been worried since they hanged him," she said. "Now I'm scared, too." "Or should that be scared?" she asked, trying to make a joke of it. Jamie made a low noise in his throat, which I think he meant to be soothing.
"He's in no more danger tonight than he was last night, lass, nor any night since he set out."
"True,"
she answered dryly,
But just because I didn't know about ghost bears and black murderers last week doesn't mean they weren't out there.
My point precisely, he replied. You'll be no safer for your fear.